we might get started as we're running a little late. My name's Bob Officer. I'm chairman of a group called Pentacle Property Funds Management, and I'm here this afternoon with a number of colleagues. Ken Atchison, who's an analyst, spends a lot of time on property, and Patrick Cremond, who's CEO of Pentacle. This is a broad overview of what we'll be talking about, particularly direct property as an asset class, the importance of asset allocation decisions, the different types of property, whether domestic or overseas, what can we expect from returns, of course always associated with risk, why you might choose a particular benchmark, what you might look from a benchmark, and of course the very important job of making decisions amongst those different asset classes. Now, it's almost inconceivable that a properly constructed investment portfolio wouldn't contain some property in it as an asset class. It's an important asset class. Of course, it's got a number of characteristics that I think make it attractive as part of your portfolio, and particularly in times like the moment. It's got a regular income stream. This makes it predictable, easy to make predictable distributions, which of course if you're managing a super fund or the like and people are dependent on that for their consumption, they do want some predictability in the distribution. It's got a low correlation, relatively low correlation with other major assets. The advantage of that, of course, means it reduces the risk of the entire portfolio. The lower the correlation, the lower the overall risk of your portfolio. That's typically measured in terms of what's known as beta risk or covariance risk. As a risk class, it really falls in between fixed interest and equities. Fixed interest, in a sense, because, of course, a lot of fixed interest is collateralized by property. And of course, if you're into a property investment, you've got the physical property. The equity component resembles the income stream, the rent roll, which of course can be variable at different times depending on what type and class of property can show some variation. So if you're looking at the risk, it's somewhere between fixed interest and equities, and typically, depending on how you measure it, what gearing you've got, you can think of beta for property at around 0.7. But I'll defer to Ken Atchison, who works full-time pretty well on analysis and a lot of that time on property, to comment on that if anyone's got any queries. Here we've got a slide in the investment objectives and clearly the asset allocation decision, which is one of the important ones. So we've decided to go into property. What proportion of a total portfolio should be in property, of course? That also depends on what your attitude is to risk and return. If you'd come through the early 90s, funds were putting less than 10% in property. They'd been severely burnt in the early 90s. It wasn't uncommon before then to see up to 25-30%. People are returning now to portfolios of the order of 20% property at the upper limit. I think 10 is more conventional, somewhere between 10 and 20. But having made that decision, we've got the problem of what property. Now, we're going to focus on the issue of direct property, and you'll see in this slide, we've got it contrasted with listed. We're not going to argue that one is superior to the other. It depends. It depends what you're looking for. In direct property, you're getting a much more focused exposure to property than you are in listed property trusts. Listed property trusts typically, increasingly, also encompass not only the property but also management services. So they tend to move more to the equity side of the property, and as a consequence show higher risk, as we'll see. In fact, we argue, and at Pentacle we adopt a policy of having some listed property, and the reason for that is direct property is relatively lumpy. To be able to get exposure, you can't simply dial up and invest like you can in LPTs or the normal equities. You've got to wait, typically, for a fund to open or a particular opportunity to arise. Now, while you're waiting for that, much better to be exposed to property through LPTs than having the money sitting in cash. You've made a decision to invest a certain proportion of your portfolio in property. You don't want a proportion of that sitting in cash while you're waiting the opportunity for a direct property investment. So it does make sense to use LPTs in that form. Also, I might add, there are occasions when, if you follow that LPT market closely, you will find particular trusts are particularly good value. That is, there are opportunities at times where an LPT investment will be a better investment than any of the direct property investments you might have as an opportunity at a particular point in time. So we're certainly not degrading LPTs, but if you want an exposure to property, you're better off taking direct property. So you use LPTs a bit like working capital with perhaps some opportunistic investments in there. Now, the other component in this graph that we might focus on is the Australian overseas issue. How much Australian, how much overseas? Again, that can be a function of opportunities. What we're finding increasingly, and it applies to all asset classes, quite frankly, not just property, analysts, asset consultants, find increasing evidence that it pays to put part of your money overseas. The question is then, of course, whether you hedge or don't hedge. Most of the direct investment in property overseas, such as through Centro and the likes, is hedged. We could mount a series of arguments, and this is not the place to do it, about what is an optimal hedging policy. If you intend holding an asset for a long time, there's good arguments not to hedge it. Ideally, you'd possibly hedge the income component of your offshore investment and leave the physical unhedged, assuming you're going to remain in that investment for a long time. But that's about all I'll say about hedging. The other point I would make, Australia is a very small proportion of the direct property market, something like our proportion of equities, about 2%. Much higher proportion of the global LPT market, we're about 10%. It makes sense, of course, from a diversification point of view, if you can get exposure to offshore property. But that's easier said than done, because you run into a lot of issues in terms of regulatory issues, sovereign risk issues, what an economist would call agency issues in investing offshore. It's much harder to manage offshore investment. So it's pretty clear that you've got to make sure when you are investing offshore, you're doing it with someone who understands the markets they're investing in. It would be rare that you'll find the one group that is able to cope with offshore investments irrespective of geography, nationality, etc. But there's very clear advantages in having some exposure offshore in terms of diversification. Now, of course, we'd make the same point about equities. Australia's had a remarkable run in equities. And if you'd been investing offshore over the last decade in equities relative to Australia, you'd wonder why. Hindsight's a great thing to have, but it's not a good investment guide per se. That is, you've got to build it up with something else. And the likelihood that the Australian investment is going to outperform offshore investment into the future, to the extent that it has in the most recent period, is pretty unlikely. The other point I'd make about offshore property is there are new products emerging and interesting products. And, of course, if you talk to those like Centro and others, they think the market here in some areas become quite saturated and they can find greater opportunities offshore. And you want to take advantage of that to the extent that you can. I'm going to slip around between slides a bit. Let me go on to slide 11. And that gives us... sorry, I've gone one too far. More than one too far. Slide 7 I should have got to. There. This gives us a rough idea of a 20-year return as a percent per annum and the volatility or risk, it's actually a measure of the standard deviation of the return, for different types of property, including Australian listed property. We'll see overall, and of course it depends on what the composition your direct property portfolio is, but a market cap has given a return of around 10%. With a volatility of about 4.4%. That contrasts with Australian listed property of a higher rate of return, but nearly double the volatility, double the risk. And then you see direct property broken down to office, retail and industrial. Now, those numbers will be very much a function of the time period. If you took a last 10 years, you'll get different numbers. If you took a 30-year period, to the extent we could and we can't, or can't get very good data, you'll get different numbers again. The fact that retail over the last decade or so has outperformed office considerably doesn't mean it's going to in the next decade. Clearly this is so. But keeping that in mind, the other component I think that's important to remember is the income component. That was the total returns of those various classes. Here's some income, 20-year average income returns, and the volatility of that income return. And you'll see a composite property there giving an income return of about 7.6. Now, that's probably at the upper level. It's certainly a lot higher than anything we could expect at the moment, depending, of course, on how much gearing you were wanting to get involved in. My rule of thumb is usually... about 50% of your total returns income and 50% capital appreciation, but that's a very broad rule of thumb. Retail property, recognising very early in this period, these returns in the current environment look high, but very early in the period, of course, we had that very high inflation. We had to have high competing yields on property or any asset, and that's why some of these numbers are quite high. They're higher, of course, than Australian shares, and that's typically always true. Dividend yields on Australian shares are around 3.5% or thereabout, whereas property is usually considerably higher than that. Again, it'll depend where you're going. At the moment, probably around 6 or a bit less. So, again, we can look at those income components, an important feature of property. And, of course, we've got to be mindful of not only the asset class that that table represents, but also locality. We've already talked about offshore, but even states and regions, and whether it's city property or country property, you'll find as you move away from central city areas, the yield will increase, the expected capital appreciation will decrease. Your total return may increase slightly because of greater risk, greater illiquidity in property as you move away from a central city. And, of course, we shouldn't forget opportunistic investment either. Now, if I go back to slide 9, what I'm going to talk about here is we've got to make a decision on how we allocate our various types of property. And, of course, embodied in that is what benchmark we're going to use to measure ourselves against. We could use a broad property index. Increasingly, funds are using absolute returns. They say they're an absolute return fund. This doesn't get away from having a benchmark. You've still got to have a benchmark. You've got to have some opportunity cost of capital that you measure yourself against. Some believe that an absolute return fund doesn't have to measure itself against anything. That's rubbish. You do have to have a benchmark. You can artificially construct one, of course, out of equities and fixed interest, but you do need a benchmark. You may set an income target for your fund and then let the residual be the capital appreciation. What we've done at Pentacle is recognising that property is somewhere midway between fixed interest investment and equities. We've taken as our benchmark a government bond yield plus a margin. So we typically are expecting about 3% over the long-term government bond yield. And that's been readily achievable over long periods. So that's our benchmark. Then the question is, how do we choose our particular benchmark portfolio? What we did, and it's in the paper that we'll be distributing, I guess, next week. I don't think people have got a copy of it yet. Ken Atchison, his firm, have done a very large number of what I'd call sensitivity analysis of looking at different proportions of retail, office, industrial, offshore, domestic, opportunistic. We've kept a proportion of our fund available for opportunities that don't fall necessarily neatly into any one risk class, recognising at times that good investment opportunities come up. You don't want to be hidebound having made some predetermined decision on what risk classes or asset classes you're going to remain in. And in addition, of course, a proportion of listed properties. We did a lot of sensitivities over time, but once again, you've got to be mindful that the past doesn't necessarily reflect the future. So in choosing our benchmark, we also had a solid dose of what we thought the future was going to look like, but being mindful of what's gone on in the past. Of course, in any investment, the past is only relevant insofar as it reflects the future, otherwise it's irrelevant. And property, like most other investments, the past is a guide, but you've got to be careful about how you translate that into the future. You won't get the same. We came to a benchmark portfolio, as illustrated in this table, about 43% retail, about 33% office, 15% industrial, special opportunities, around 5%, and listed property, which, as I pointed out, we're using to some extent like working capital. And it's that benchmark portfolio that we're measuring ourselves against. Now, this is the 20-year income returns, which you've already mentioned, and that's the volatility of them. Manager selection. So we've made the decision on what our benchmark portfolio should look like with a range around it. You'll need a range in direct property because, as I've said already, you won't get immediate access to all the properties that you might want. And the question is then, how do you select your managers? Well, you want an expert investor in retail. It's different to office. The management of retail is different to managing an office property or industrial, and clearly offshore and special opportunities. What we've done at Pentacle, and it's not the only way you could do it, but we've formed an expert investment committee made up of a property analyst, which is Ken Atchison. We've got a person who was responsible for much of his career managing properties for an industrial super fund on there. We've got another fellow who specialises in LPTs to help us within our range decide on what proportion we'll have in LPTs. We've got a couple of portfolio specialists, and we've got some people who actively buy and manage properties. Now, the importance of having such a committee is when a fund comes to present, they're going to be cross-examined from a number of different aspects. Not the least, of course, is how they manage their properties. The nitty-gritty, the details, the probability that they're going to have some vacancies, what's their occupancy rates look like, and the like. And similarly, when they come in with offshore investments, with people who on the investment committee who understand the question of hedging, foreign exchange, how they're handling it, where their expertise is offshore. It's unlikely if you're going to be investing in US retail, for example, and Australians, by and large, have invested quite a bit in US retail, you're going to need some experience and, of course, a lot of offshore expertise located in the US. You can't do it from Sydney or Melbourne. So that manager selection is very important. Ultimately, we're looking at the various products, types of property, remembering all the time you're trying to get a well-diversified exposure to direct property because of the inherent attributes of property. And the only way you'll get a well-diversified portfolio of direct property is in the different classes of property, different sectors, the locale or geography, where it is, where it's located. You need to be mindful of commercial risk. You don't want overexposure to one particular type of asset class or one particular manager if you want to minimise the risk of your property portfolio. And then, of course, you need to have your expectations of return, remembering there's no free lunch in this. You go for high expected returns, you'll take on risk. That's why there's no absolute right portfolio. Benefit of hindsight, of course, we can say I should have been in that portfolio. Looking forward, it depends on your appetite to risk, the nature of your portfolio. Typically, direct property investments are lower geared than LPTs. This is one of the reasons why they tend to be lower risk. And finally, mindful of liquidity. People at times can't, or they might think they're committing for 10 years, and then they find there's a family issue arisen, they need to get out. So you need to have some sensitivity about how liquid your portfolio is likely to be. How easy is it to get out of that portfolio? At Pentacle, we've managed that through options and also, as I said, maintaining a proportion in LPTs. So unless there's a great rush for the door, we can manage liquidity. I'd have to say I'm also chairman of a microcap trust. We've got a clause that holds people up for 9 months. This is a trust of equities, which you think should be liquid, but if you go through an 87 or other periods, which I have been through, and everyone wants to get out the door at the same time, you've got to be very conscious it can't be done. So there's got to be restrictions to some extent on how liquid you can get a direct portfolio. Don't kid yourself that you can get a direct portfolio that is as liquid as one of the top 50 portfolios of equities. You won't get it unless you've got someone standing on the other side of you who's guaranteeing to buy you in such circumstance, and of course you'll pay for that. So finally, we use historical analysis. It helps us set a benchmark asset allocation, but of course we're tempering that with what we expect going forward. In our particular case, we've chosen a benchmark of 10-year bonds plus 3%, which is yielding a total return of about 10% at the moment and an income return of a little less than 7% in direct. You want stable income for distribution purposes. That's one of the advantages of property. And, of course, the asset allocation, the various classes of property help you frame those investment opportunities. Now, I'm very mindful of the fact I was going to defer to my colleague Ken Atchison down here, who spent a lot more time on analysis of property than I have. So if there's questions, I might duck them by sending them to Ken, particularly any questions involving data. Yes?
I was just going to just say, there's no mention of tax advantage components when you talk about yields.
Yeah. That is important, I think, particularly and how much you may return by way of a capital appreciation. You're not locked into when you sell properties, of course. You can get some considerable tax advantages, as a number of the funds do. I mean, for example, Centro looks after most of our retail. That's considerably tax advantage, the return you're getting from that, and that's a good point. Yeah. Well, Australian REITs, the LPTs, of course, have had a remarkable period. I'm not a contrarian. I think because something has gone up in the past, it's necessarily going to fall. But you can't expect, given the risk class, that the outperformance is going to continue. That would be unreasonable. So I'm not forecasting a downturn or rationalising it. I'm just simply saying that given the risk class of LPTs, you wouldn't expect them to outperform to the extent they have over the last few years. Ken?
Just to add to that, I think the LPT market, perhaps as Bob said, is probably incredibly large, at 20% per annum for the last 3 years until they hit the brick wall earlier this year. Is it giving us a lead on what's going to happen in the direct market? I think just a fraction. The direct market was never as aggressively priced as the listed market. So we feel a lot more comfortable with the direct market.
Does the low risk with direct property come from the fact that the volatility only comes when someone buys it? So the volatility is inherently low, because you buy a property, you might hold it 5 years, and is it a pretty crude comparison against equities, which are priced minute by minute?
Yeah.
So if you're actually looking at an average turnover of property being 5 years, then should you not look at the equity index every 5 years?
Yeah, I'll let. It's a good point. The point is, you know, the mere fact that we get a measurement daily on an LPT and might only measure the performance on a direct property portfolio annually, clearly you're going to get greater variation on
so
when you...
My point is, it perceived lower risk?
Well, I think... Yeah, I think, well, in part it is, but the point I would also make, and Ken can follow up, typically LPTs are more highly geared, and they're also more exposed to property management services, which tend to be more volatile. So the point you're making about the number of cuts will have some effect on volatility. But inherently, and this is one of the important points I make, LPTs are not direct property. They're not identical, apart from the trading aspects of it. And it's a very important point to recognise, because increasingly they're getting further apart in terms of the underlying assets that you're getting exposed to. And the point I'm making is, if you want a property exposure, you're better off direct property, although there are attributes in LPT that I've mentioned. Ken, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I just had one comment at the margin, because your point is very valid, and value is only value property. Is a general rule once every 12 months, so the measured performance is different. The attribute that Bob put up on one of the slides on the income slide, and I'm not sure which number it is, number 11. The volatility of income from direct property is 0.2, and the income level is about the same. The volatility of income of listed property is 2.6. Listed property, even the income side, is a lot more volatile, and that's because of the nature of what's in listed trusts. So the inherent characteristic of direct property is a more stable one. do we accentuate that stability by measuring it only on an annual basis? Yes, we do, but it still has a very powerful distinctive characteristic that's different. A huge driver of returns in all investment assets in the last decade has been the decline in long-term bond rates, which is your basic risk-free rate. And that has contributed to the relatively high returns that we've seen in all investment markets, and it's contributed to the return in direct property as well. You hear yield contraction, spread contraction's been talked about, and that has happened. Looking forward, we're looking at the income side, and we're looking at what will contribute to returns from direct property. Income round about, give or take, let's call it 6, and we can argue whether it's 6 or 6.5. In Australia, rental income growth, the supply-demand equation is such that rental income growth is looking very promising. And we're looking at income growth from rental income 3% plus. So without any particular valuation impact, we're looking at a 9% plus return looking forward. Are prices excessively valued in the direct market? Probably we'll see a little bit of a sell-off given what's happening in the credit markets, a little bit of change in valuations in the immediate future. But we would see, going forward, this rental income growth being picked up into the values of property. So returns of the high single digits is what we're looking for in Australia from direct property. Our Pentacle investments will be smooth right through the year, so you're not going to get any particular clustering. And most portfolios now of substance will be also spreading out. So they might do annual valuations, but do a block each in each quarter.
What you've got to make sure is people can't game you. That is, knowing a valuation has come up, knowing the property market in general has gone up, for say, 5% in the last 3 months, you don't want people being able to game by buying in at the last. So we've got indexing and processes that, while it mightn't be 100% accurate, it is unbiased. So it won't encourage people to buy in at a particular point in time. You've got to be careful about that. There is sometimes opportunities. If you know a specific fund, know when they value, know what the market's done, hey, I should go in at this time because I'll pick up that valuation that's gone on over the last couple of months. We are careful to try and eliminate that.
Yeah, I might take that as an opportunity just to talk a little bit about the Pentacle funds. We are a fairly unique, unlisted property fund in that we are putting that asset allocation work that Ken has described into a single unitised product. We are invested in some syndicate products, but more than 50% of our portfolio is actually in open-ended wholesale-style products, particularly as we look at the nature of those portfolios, which tend to be lower geared, which is particularly attractive to us in the current environment, and have slightly more attractive fee structures. We also are providing a conduit for access for the retail investor into a market that previously they haven't really been able to access. You know, a lot of these wholesale funds are minimum $1, $2, $5, $10 million. And so what we're trying to do is package that type of product together with some syndicate product, which provides us usually a slightly more attractive yield, into a highly diversified unlisted property portfolio. You mentioned liquidity. We have two versions of our fund. One is less liquid than the other. The less liquid fund is pure unlisted property with about a 5% allocation to LPTs, and we would handle redemptions there over a 6-month time frame. In our enhanced fund, which is our 3-day liquid fund, we are handling the portfolio construction is exactly the same. In fact, the enhanced fund is an investor into the standard fund. What we've done is put option arrangements in place with underlying managers to sell back product to them as and when we need liquidity. Now, in the first instance, we would match applications with redemptions. In the second instance, we would rely on LPTs, and then the final resort for us is to rely on these arrangements which have been put in place with the underlying fund managers. Now, to call ourselves a liquid fund, we have to be able to have those arrangements that cover 80% of our assets, and we do have that. Bob talked earlier about the other points on here, so in the interest of time, I'll just quickly show, if I can, our current portfolio and our strategic asset allocation. The strategic asset allocation is more or less the benchmark portfolio that Ken has described. At the moment, our allocation is about 45% to retail, so we're pretty much spot on our strategic asset allocation. We're slightly underweight office and slightly overweight industrial. Rather than that being a conscious investment decision, that's a function of lumpiness of our investments. In our office portfolio, we've got a $10 million commitment to one fund manager that hasn't been drawn down yet. As soon as that's drawn down, that asset allocation will switch around. As you can see at the moment, we have a zero allocation to listed, and that's partly reflecting a reflection of the current market state. And we have about market weight or a strategic asset allocation weight in special opportunities, which is the development funds that we talked about. I'm getting the wrap-up sign from the back, so I think we now is time to...
quick question. How big is
We finished June 30 at about $18 million. So that was our first year. Our performance, sorry, I showed it on there, was about 12% for the year.